The Roswell incident, Charles Burlett. Tell me you've read it. A wedding? Well, we'll see if we can get some Sunday. You can stop taking calls for a while. Berlitz is an interesting writer. This was written 1980s. It's been around a long time. According to UFO legend, an extraterrestrial spaceship crashed in New Mexico in the early days of July 1947. This would seem to be on the surface simply another report that has been kept alive in UFO journals and the thousands of books written about UFOs in all languages. What is different about this case, however, is the vitality of this one single incident and its continuing developments in scientific, government, and legal circles. At the time this book goes to press, a civil action has been brought by concerned parties, Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, through their attorneys, against the CIA for the purpose of releasing information about crashed UFOs in accord with the terms of the Freedom of Information Act. CAUS, in addition, has taken over a previous suit of the Ground Saucer Watch against the CIA. Among the charges brought by the suits are suppression of media information, withholding of files, muzzling of witnesses, and in general, hiding information through the use of now unnecessary security classification. Events which had been reported in the press and by radio before security regulations were imposed by the Army Air Force, whose name was changed to the Air Force in that very year, 1947, indicate that material from the wrecked UFO was shuttled by high-security government transportation from base to base, and that the remains of the UFO and the dead occupants, one of whom was reportedly alive when found, are under high-security guard at CIA headquarters at Langley, Virginia. While much has been written about UFO sightings and encounters on Earth, little has been openly written about encounters with UFOs in space exploration. A rather convincing indication of the presence of UFOs in Earth space, and how far do those boundaries extend, has been furnished by mathematician, physicist, and author Maurice Chatelain, a designer of the Apollo spacecraft and former chief of the NASA communications for the Apollo lunar missions, and an outspoken documentalist of one special phase of close encounters in space by explorers, U.S., from Earth with entities from elsewhere. According to Chatelain's accounts, some of which are based on information picked up from inside sources while working for NASA in the 60s, and other relying on data passed on to him later by friends and former colleagues, reports of these encounters made during flights in space. They've been generally censored, altered, de-emphasized, or simply ignored by NASA, and therefore never reached the public at the time of their occurrence. The fact that the astronauts were on military duty was, according to Chatelain, a great and perhaps planned advantage for secrecy, inasmuch as they could simply be ordered not to discuss aspects of their UFO encounters. Although the majority of U.S. astronauts are no longer on active duty, they have steadfastly maintained a discreet silence on this topic right up to the present day, leaving us with only Chatelain's inside accounts to hint at what might really have gone on in space and even over the surface of the moon. These, to say the least, are visibly impressive. The following table is detailed in chronological order. spacecraft and date. Mercury, May 16th, 63. Crew, Cooper. Incident. Over Hawaii, picked up voices on special frequency speaking in language later examined on tape and found to belong to no known Earth language. Passing over Perth, Australia, and Joe Shack, go up and work with the sound because I got too much bass in it. Passing over Perth, Australia, saw a large UFO, also observed a checking station on Earth. Spacecraft, date, Gemini 4, June 3rd, 64. McDivitt White, the crew. Incident. Over Hawaii, almost collided with silver cylinder, oval with luminous trail. Photographed it. Spacecraft, date, Gemini 7. December 4th, 1965. Crew, Borman, Lovell. Incident. Took pictures of enormous UFO with propulsion systems following capsule. Spacecraft, Gemini 9, date, June 3rd, 66, crew, Stafford Cernan. Incident, capsule accompanied from takeoff by many UFOs seen by ground as well as by capsule crew. Spacecraft, Gemini 10, date, July 18, 66, crew, Young, Collins. Two UFOs followed and disappeared when capsule asked ground station for radar observation. Later, a huge object, not a planet or planetoid, was observed. Too cold in here. Spacecraft, Gemini 11, date, September 12, 1966. Crew, Gordon and Conrad. Incident, long object sighted over Madagascar. NASA said it was Soviet Proton 3, but that was 350 miles away at the time of sighting. Spacecraft, Apollo 8, date, December 21, 1968, crew, Borman, Lovell, Anders. Incident, sighted disc-shaped UFOs as capsule circled moon. Reported, quote, we have been informed that Santa Claus does exist, end quote. Also picked up unidentifiable language on space frequency radio. Spacecraft, Apollo 10. Am I boring you? I thought we'd have some fun with this tonight. May 18, 26, 1969. Crew, Stafford, Young, and Cernan. Incident, sighted two UFOs following capsule during orbit of moon and homeward flight. Spacecraft, Apollo 11. Date, July 16, 1969, the moon landing. Crew, Armstrong, Collins, and Aldrin. Incident. Prior to the first moon landing, two UFOs and a long cylinder hovered overhead. When Apollo 11 landed inside a moon crater, two unidentified spacecrafts appeared on the crater rim and then took off again. Aldrin photographed them. Pictures have not yet been released by NASA to the public. Spacecraft, Apollo 12, date, November 14, 1969. Crew, Conrad, Gordon, and Bean. Incident. Observatories on Earth observe capsule being accompanied by two brilliant UFOs near moon. Then, when near Earth before landing, large UFO with red lights was observed. Spacecraft, Apollo 17, date, December 7 to 19, 1972. Crew, Cernan, Evans, and Smith. Incident, saw UFOs near Earth, close to moon, and in between. Additional confirmation that the Apollo 11 astronauts had indeed experienced some strange moments on their five-day flight to the moon and back comes from a source apparently associated with Anglia TV in London. According to this source, NASA was forced to change the originally intended landing site for the Eagle lander module because it was discovered that the first site was, quote, crawling, presumably with somebody else's space hardware. As evidence, the Anglia source cites the following alleged, quote, deleted bit of conversation obtained through an unnamed intermediary, purported to have taken place between astronaut Colonel Edwin Buzz Aldrin and NASA Mission Control sometime prior to the lunar landing on July 20th, 1969. Quote, Aldrin. What was it? What the hell was it? That's all I want to know. Mission Control, what's there? Garble malfunction in the sound. And Mission Control calling Apollo 11. Aldrin. These babies were huge, sir. Enormous. Oh, God, you wouldn't believe it. I'm telling you, there are other spacecraft out here, lined up on the far side of the crater edge. They're on the moon watching us. You know, the way you can jump on the moon, I would have gone in orbit. Many reports are circulated. Most of you are aware of them and wonder how much is truth and how much is false. I'm still wondering. It's like science fiction scenario. But one scene was rather conventionally carried out in New Mexico some years ago, and the first scene could be titled as follows. Place, the teletype room of Radio KOAT, Albuquerque, New Mexico. Time, July 7, 1947, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Lydia Sleppy, what a name, who in addition to her other office and administrative duties for radio station KOAT in Albuquerque, New Mexico, was also the teletype operator. She was sitting at her machine at the station at approximately 4 p.m., the date was July 7, 1947. You still don't have the sound right, Joe. Suddenly the phone rang with a message that would affect news reports for the next few days throughout the world, and whose import may not yet be fully apparent. The call from that ringing phone was from Johnny McBoyle, reporter and part owner of sister station KSWS in Roswell, New Mexico, a station which had no teletype of its own, but which frequently used the KOAT machine when it had something to report. This time, his voice was excited. Lydia, get ready for a scoop. We want to get this on the ABC wire right away. Listen to this. A flying saucer has crashed. No, I'm not joking. It crashed near Roswell. I've been there and seen it. It's like a big crumpled dishpan. Some rancher has hauled it under a cattle shelter with his tractor. The army is there, and they're going to pick it up. The whole area is now closed off, and get this. They're saying something about little men being on board. Start getting this on the teletype right away while I'm on the phone. Understandably bemused, Lydia placed the phone in the uncomfortable position between ear and shoulder and started to type McBoyle's startling statements into the teletype. But after she had typed only several sentences, the machine suddenly stopped itself. As this is a common occurrence with teletypes for a variety of reasons, Lydia was not concerned, although she had never been cut off the air before in the middle of a transmission. Moving the telephone from her neck to her hand, she informed McBoyle that the teletype had stopped at her end. This time, according to her recollections, he seemed not only excited, but under pressure. And apparently, And apparently, see, you were wrong about me. Speaking to someone else at the same time. His voice seemed strained. Wait a minute, he said. I'll get back to you. Wait. I'll get right back. But he did not. You were wrong about me a second time. But he did not. Instead, the teletype went on again by itself and started addressing Albuquerque or Lydia directly. The sender was not identified, and the tone was formal and curt. Attention, Albuquerque. Going to finish this?
Yes, sir.
The Roswell incident, Charles Berlitz. Berlitz Language School fame. He's the son. Come on, if you want me to read any more, you better go on telephone. Cleveland, Ohio calling. Says there's this 800 number on the screen and a guy sitting there talking about UFOs. He said if we wanted to hear more to call, so I'm calling. I'd like to hear more. Who is this guy? Me. I got camera people who can't find the middle of the screen, though. Thank you, Peter. Great to have the doc dangling again. Are you becoming Dr. Participle again? And turning this into a hard day's night, believing us dangling? Yes, until I hear a phone call from 1610 or 690 Alf Anguilla. Blame Anguilla if I don't read any more of this book tonight. Well, don't blame Anguilla. Blame those listening to 1610 and 690. That aren't calling. If I don't hear a call from someone listening on 1610 AM or 690 AM, the Caribbean beacon off of British West Indies island of Anguilla, I'm not going to read anymore. I'll get on telephone. Okay, poor Lydia Sleppy. Sitting at her machine in radio station KOAT in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Too hot in here now. Can you find some place in between those two extremes? She was the teletype operator sitting at her machine approximately 4 p.m. The date was July 7, 1947, and I'm reading Charles Berlitz and William L. Moore, The Roswell Incident, written in 1980. The date was July 7, 1947. Suddenly the phone rang with a message that would affect news reports for days throughout the world. The call was from Johnny McBoyle, reporter and part owner of sister station KSWS in Roswell, New Mexico. A station which had no teletype of its own, but which frequently used the KOAT machine when it had something to report. This time his voice was excited. Lydia, get ready for a scoop. We want to get this on the ABC wire right away. Listen to this. A flying saucer has crashed. No, I'm not joking. It crashed near Roswell. I've been there and seen it. It's like a big crumpled dishpan. Some rancher has hauled it under a cattle shelter with his tractor, and the army's there, and they're going to pick it up. The whole area is now closed off. And get this, they're saying something about little men being on board. Start getting this on the teletype right away while I'm on the phone. Understandably bemused, Lydia placed the phone in the uncomfortable position between ear and shoulder and started to type McBoyle's startling statements into the teletype. But after she had typed only several sentences, the machine suddenly stopped itself. As this is a common occurrence with teletypes for a variety of reasons, Lydia was not concerned. Although she had never been cut off the air before in the middle of a transmission. Moving the telephone from her neck to her hand, she informed McBoyle that the teletype had stopped at her end. This time, according to her recollections, he seemed not only excited, but under pressure and apparently speaking to someone else at the same time. His voice seemed strained. "Wait a minute, I'll get back to you. Wait, I'll get right back." But he did not. Instead, the teletype went on again by itself and started addressing Albuquerque or Lydia directly. The sender was not identified, and the tone was formal and curt. "Attention, Albuquerque." That's where I was. That's where we stopped. 1610 call. Generation New York. "Attention, Albuquerque. Do not transmit." Repeat. "Do not transmit this message. Stop communication immediately." As Lydia still had McBoyle on the phone, she told him what had just come over the teletype and asked, "What do I do now?" His reply was unexpected. I bet we sell some of these books. "Forget about it. You never heard it. Look, you're not supposed to know. Don't talk about it to anyone." McBoyle later told Lydia Sleppy that he had witnessed a plane which he said was destined for Wright Field, Wright-Patterson, take off with the objects or parts of it on board, but was unable to get anywhere near it because of the tight security maintained by heavily armed guards. Although this was Lydia's last connection with the, quote, happening, she had ample time for subsequent reflection about it, since it was to become a topic of considerable discussion after the return of her boss, Merle Tucker, who had been out of town at the time of the occurrence. Tucker was concerned that his station's involvement in the incident could jeopardize his recent application for an FCC license for a subsidiary station he was preparing to add to his Rio Grande broadcasting network. At about 10 minutes to 10 on the evening of July 2nd, 1947, local hardware dealer Dan Wilmot and his wife were sitting on the front porch of their South Pennsylvania Street home in Roswell, New Mexico, enjoying a cool respite from what had been one of those hot New Mexico summer days. In Wilmot's words, all of a sudden, a big, glowing object zoomed out of the sky from the southeast. It was going northwest toward Corona, New Mexico, at a high rate of speed. Now, this was preceded by a whole series of claimed sightings. This is July 2nd, June 25th, 1947. A saucer-shaped object about one-half the size of the full moon was reported moving south over Silver City, New Mexico, by the local dentist, Dr. R.F. Sessenbauger. June 26th, the next day, 1947, Leon Oettinger, M.D., of Lexington, Kentucky, and three other witnesses reported a large, silver, ball-shaped object, clearly not a balloon or dirigible, traveling at high speed near the edge of the Grand Canyon. June 27, 1947, John A. Petschy, an electrician at Phelps Dodge Corporation, and other witnesses reported a disc-shaped object overhead and apparently coming to Earth about 10:30 a.m. near Tintown in the vicinity of Bisbee in southeastern Arizona near the New Mexico border. You radio people are going to have to get used to these pauses while I light my cigar or my pipe. June 27, 1947. Major George B. Wilcox of Warren, Arizona, reported a series of 8 or 9 perfectly spaced discs traveling at high speed with a wobbling motion. He said the discs passed over his house at 3-second intervals heading east and estimated them to be at a height of about 1,000 feet above the mountaintops. June 27th, same day, 1947, a, quote, white disc glowing like an electric light bulb, end quote, was reported to have passed over Pope, New Mexico, by local resident W.C. Dobbs at 9:50 a.m. Minutes later, the same or a similar object was sighted traveling southwest over the White Sands Missile Range by Captain E.B. Detchmendy, who reported it to his commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Harold R. Turner. At 10 a.m., Mrs. David Appelzoller of San Miguel, New Mexico, reported that a similar object had passed over that city, again heading southwest. Colonel Turner of White Sands initially reacted by announcing that no rockets had been launched from that base since June 12th. Later, fearing hysteria, he officially, quote, identified the object as a, quote, daytime meteorite. June 28th, the next day, 1947. Captain F. Devine, a pilot flying in the vicinity of Alamogordo, New Mexico, witnessed, quote, a ball of fire with a fiery blue trail behind it, end quote, pass beneath his aircraft and appeared to disintegrate while he watched. June 29th. 1947, next day. Army Air Force pilots conducted a search for an object reported to have fallen near Cliff, New Mexico, sometime in the forenoon, but find nothing but a curious odor in the air. Same day, June 29, 1947, the day after Captain Devine saw the ball of fire disintegrate, a team of naval rocket test experts headed by Dr. C.J. Zone on duty at the White Sands Proving Grounds watched a silvery-colored disc do a series of maneuvers at high altitude over the secret rocket test range. You didn't find the spot, Brad. It's too cold now. June 30, 1947. Next day, 13 silvery disc-shaped objects were observed by a railroad worker named Price, traveling one after another over Albuquerque, New Mexico. Initially heading south, they changed course abruptly to east and then reversed dramatically to west before disappearing. Price alerted his neighbors, And the entire neighborhood rushed out of their houses to lie on their lawns and observe the maneuvers in the sky above them. Same day, June 30, 1947, as reported from the Tucumcari, New Mexico Daily News on July 9th. Quote, Mrs. Helen Hardine, employee of Quay County Abstract Company, reported Tuesday, July 8th, that she saw a flying saucer from her front porch about 11 p.m. June 30th, traveling from east to west at high speed. She said it looked to be about half the size of the full moon with a slight yellow cast. She watched it for about 6 seconds, low in the sky and going down outside of town rather than close in. She at first thought it was a meteor, but noticed a whirling motion as it neared the ground. Also, it was not falling as fast as meteors do. July 1, 1947. Max Hood, an executive of the Albuquerque Chamber of Commerce, reported seeing a bluish disk zigzagging across the northwestern sky over Albuquerque. July 1 to 6, 1947. Seven separate reports of flying disks over northern Mexico, ranging from Mexicali to Juarez. July 1, 1947. Mr. and Mrs. Frank Munn reported witnessing a large object moving east over Phoenix about 9 p.m. July 2, 1947. About 10 minutes to 10 on the evening of July 2nd, 1947, and this is where I was, local hardware dealer Dan Wilmot and his wife were sitting on the front porch of their South Penn Street home in Roswell, New Mexico. All of a sudden, in Wilmot's words, a big glowing object zoomed out of the sky from the southeast. It was going northwest toward Corona, New Mexico, at a high rate of speed. Somewhat startled, Wilmot and his wife ran out into their yard to watch as an oval object shaped, quote, like two inverted saucers faced mouth to mouth and glowing as if lit from the inside passed over their house and out of sight to the northwest in 40 to 50 seconds. Although Wilmot described the mysterious object as having been completely silent, Mrs. Wilmot later said she thought she had heard a slight swishing sound for a brief moment as the object passed overhead. Concerned that he might be leaving himself open to ridicule, Wilmot described by the Roswell Daily Record as one of the most respected and reliable citizens in town, kept silent about his experience for nearly a week in hopes that someone else would come out and tell about having seen one. But nobody told Wilmot anything that might corroborate his experience until on July 8th, an unusual release to the press came from the public information officer at the Roswell base. In view of the ensuing excitement, it may have occurred later to Wilmot that he had seen a preview of an incident which later developed into a well-kept and continuing secret, at least as far as the public was concerned. It was not treated as such when it first appeared. Or first happened. On July 8, one day after Mrs. Sleppy's unusual incident with the TWX teletype machine, Lieutenant Walter Haupt, public information officer at the Roswell Army Air Base, acting on information beginning to filter into the Roswell Air Base, jumped the gun in a burst of excitement and enthusiastically issued the following release to members of the press without first bothering to obtain the authorization of his base commander, Colonel William Blanchard, an oversight he was to be made painfully aware of later. Quote, This is the release. Roswell Army Air Base, Roswell, New Mexico, 8th July, 1947 a.m. The many rumors regarding the flying disc became a reality yesterday when the intelligence officer of the 509th Bomb Group of the 8th Air Force Roswell Army Airfield was fortunate enough to gain possession of a disc through the cooperation of one of the local ranchers and the sheriff's office of Chavez County. The flying object landed on a ranch near Roswell sometime last week. Not having phone facilities, the rancher stored the disc until such time as he was able to contact the sheriff's office, who in turn notified Major Jesse A. Marcel of the 509th Bomb Group Intelligence Office. Continuing, the release said, quote, "Action was immediately taken, and the disc was picked up at the rancher's home. It was inspected at the Roswell Army Airfield and subsequently loaned by Major Marcel to higher headquarters." End of release. This release, which was enthusiastically picked up by the Associated Press and the New York Times Wire Service and others, managed to appear in numerous newspapers across the United States, as well as a number of foreign journals, including the prestigious London Times. The day before the release from the Army base, an AP release went out over the wire service, Dateline San Francisco, July 7th, under the headline, "Flying Saucers Seen in Most States Now," dealing with a phenomenal increase in UFO sightings in the United States during the previous 2 weeks. It almost served as an introduction to the incident, which would attain worldwide preeminence the next day. The Roswell Daily Record rushed into print on July 8th, reading from the Roswell incident with Charles Berlitz and William L. Moore, published in 1980. The Roswell Daily Record rushed into print on July 8th with the following report, captioned, "RAAF captures flying saucer in Roswell region. No details of flying discs are revealed." The following article implied both a solution of the flying saucer controversy and a suggestion that the AAF was already involved in the beginnings of cover-up. Pertinent points of the article follow. Quote, "The intelligence officer of the 509th Bombardment Group at Roswell Army Airfield announced at noon today that the field had come into possession of a flying saucer. According to information released by the department over authority of Major J.A. Marcel, intelligence officer, the disc was recovered on a ranch in the Roswell vicinity after an unidentified rancher had notified Sheriff George Wilcox here that he had found the instrument on his premises. Major Marcel and a detail from his department went to the ranch and recovered the disc," it was stated. "After the intelligence office here had inspected the instrument, it was flown by aircraft to higher headquarters. The intelligence office stated that no details of the saucer's construction or its appearance had been revealed." End of those parts of that article. Another article in the same July 8th issue of the Roswell Daily Record reported that the operator and pilots of a private airfield at Carrizozo, about 35 miles southwest of the Brazil crash site, claimed to have seen a similar object in flight, according to the article. Quote, "Mark Sloan, operator of the Carrizozo flying field, reported a flying saucer sped over the field at about a 4,000 to a 6,000 foot altitude. Sloan said the phenomenon was observed by himself. Grady Warren, flying instructor, and Nolan Lovelace, Ray Schaefer, and another man, all pilots. He made this description, subquote. When we first noticed it at about 10 a.m., we thought it resembled a feather because it was oscillating. Then we noticed its great speed and decided it was a flying saucer. Our guesses are that it was moving at between 200 and 600 miles per hour. It passed over the field and almost directly up from southwest to northwest and was in sight in all only about 10 seconds. Here's a photocopy of the Roswell paper. Tuesday, July 8th, 1947. With the article, no details of flying disc are revealed. Now, it could, of course, be suspected that Sloan had latched on to the incident to give some publicity to his flying field. But later it was to appear that numerous other witnesses had heard or seen something very unusual in the sky over Roswell around the time of the landing of a still unidentified flying object. Perhaps the weather had something to do with the sightings and the alleged crash. Some 75 miles to the northwest, one of the worst lightning storms to strike the area in a long time was beginning to rage over the bleak New Mexico landscape. Lightning storms had occasionally brought down aircraft in the past. The sketchy information used by Lieutenant Hout to write his initial news release was hardly sufficient to supply the press with certain additional details of possible crucial importance, which numerous other witnesses, including ranchers, soldiers, a civil engineer, a group of student archaeologists, and law enforcement officers had observed at two distinctly different sites within the area that were apparently connected with the same crash. These reputedly included a large flying saucer and the remains of half a dozen or so humanoid creatures, pale in skin coloring, about 4 feet tall and dressed in a kind of one-piece jumpsuit uniform. Nor did they mention a great quantity of highly unusual wreckage, much of it metallic in nature, apparently originating from the same object and described by Major Marcel as, quote, nothing made on this earth, end quote. Neither was any mention made to the press of later information reported by witnesses concerning certain columns of hieroglyphic-like writings or recordings on a wooden-like substance that was not wood and similar unknown lettering on the control panels of the disc or saucer. Lieutenant Hout had ample opportunity to regret even the small amount of information he had given out is now evident. Almost immediately, a news blackout descended over Roswell while higher authorities as far away as the Pentagon decided what the next move would be. Several hours later, a new bit of information was suddenly released. It now appeared that the object was merely a crashed weather balloon. Most papers copied this new information, with the notable exception of the Washington Post, which referred rather pointedly to a news blackout. Boring you?
No, sir.
Meanwhile, Brigadier General Roger M. Ramey, commander of the 8th Air Force District at Fort Worth, was alerted by a phone call from Lieutenant General Hoyt Vandenberg, Deputy Chief of the Air Force, that pieces of the object...
This is the end of Side 1. Thank you.